Group B was dead to begin with. There's no doubt whatever about that. And the end of Group B is wholly the reason for the car that I'm talking about today on the Race Car Podcast, which is the 1989 Audi 90 GTO. All right, guys, welcome back to the Race Car Podcast. So, full disclosure on this one, I am 110% an Audi fanboy. I love Audi. I love all of their race cars. In fact, this car, the 90 GTO, is maybe my favorite of all of them. It's bonkers. It's crazy. It's from my favorite era of racing. It's just, it's all the things that I like all in one neat little package. And it's, this is probably the first episode that I've done specifically about a car that I really, really like. The BT52 was chosen for me by a computer program. The Nissan GTR LM Nismo is just something that's just weird, and I just wanted to talk about it. What else did I do? The 850 BTCC. I mean, that's a cool car. Everybody loves a station wagon. And then the Ferrari 637. Again, I thought it was a cool story. Not necessarily something that I'm obsessed with, but I am obsessed with the 1989 Audi 90 GTO. So I apologize in advance. You're going to get some Audi episodes. There's probably going to be episodes for every one of Audi's Le Mans racers. So be the R8, the R8C, the other R8, the R10, the R15, the R18, the R18 e-tron Quattro. You know, Audi is coming back to Le Mans with a LMDH in 2023. We're going to talk about that one, too. I'll probably go back to the 1930s. We're going to talk a little bit of Auto Union. Why not? Let's talk Auto Union. But this one is, I think, my favorite. Like I said, it's really just all of the things that I think are super cool. It's a neat story. It has kind of an evolution to talk about, which is neat. I mean, the BT52 won a driver's championship, but I think that this car, I don't know, I feel like it's more accomplished. I feel like it really did the things that it set out to do even more than the BT52 did. So, 1989 Audi 90 GTO IMSA, let's get into it. So, Audi shook up the world of rally and eventually motorsports with the debut of the Audi Quattro in 1980. So, it was a car based on the Audi 80. The Quattro introduced Audi's full-time four-wheel drive Quattro system and paired it with a turbocharged engine. So, at the time, most other manufacturers thought that four-wheel drive systems were more or less something for trucks. They thought it was too heavy for use in normal road cars, and it is interesting that it is something that it seems very commonplace right now, that almost any passenger car that you can think of has a four-wheel drive variant. You know, I used to work at Lexus, and if there was a four-wheel drive variant of the car, be it an IS or a GS or an LS, you know, whatever it was, living in Rhode Island, if the car was rear-wheel drive, nobody wanted it. We actually sent a GS down to Florida in exchange for, like, a bag of golf balls or something. So, four-wheel drive in the 80s, you know, it wasn't something that people thought of as a performance thing. It was for trucks. So, but there was, I guess, somebody that could see the bigger picture, and that was Audi chassis engineer Jörg Benzinger. He saw the Volkswagen Iltis, which was, it was the replacement for the Volkswagen 181, which, if you're an American like I am, you know is the Volkswagen thing. But he saw what the Iltis could do in the snow, and he said, well, God, why can't we do this with road cars? So they came up with the Quattro. Audi decided the thing to do was to take it racing. So Audi took advantage of the FIA Group 4 regulations, which allowed four-wheel drive systems, and they entered a Quattro in the 80 Algarve Rally in Portugal as what they call a zero car. So I'm not going to pretend like I know anything about rally because I really, really don't. A zero car, also called an opening car, is apparently a car that runs the stage ahead of the actual competitors to let spectators know that the race was about to start and also to check out the stage for hazards. So it's not a car that's competing in the race, but it is a car that is running. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's what it is. So while not competing, Audi did have the car driven by a well-respected rally driver, Hannu Mikkola, or maybe Mikkola. Again, Finnish names, I don't know. So Audi entered this car as the zero car, and its time over the whole rally was more than 30 minutes faster than the eventual event winner's time. So the car, it was heavy, it was kind of floundery to drive because it is much bigger than the cars that you would usually see being driven and that kind of stuff. But just the combination of grip and the acceleration from the Quattro and the turbocharged engine, it was going to blow everything away. Oddly enough, the winner of that event was a Fiat 131, which is driven by Walter Roll, who would end up driving for Audi in a Group B Audi Quattro and would actually also end up driving our star car today, the 90 GTO. So for our purposes, the car that we need to look at is the Audi Sport Quattro S1. This is like, if you just think of a Group B rally car in your head, this is the car that you're seeing, is the Audi Sport Quattro S1. It's Audi's final Group B car. It was powered by a 2.1-liter turbocharged inline five-cylinder engine, and it made, let's just say, comfortably more than 500 horsepower. Audi actually also experimented with their first dual-clutch gearbox in this car, which was a PDK box that was borrowed from Porsche's 956 program, which is, you know, kind of neat. By 1986, the end of Group B, the Quattro had kind of been outclassed by smaller, lighter, purpose-built cars. Peugeot 205 T16. I'm sure there was other stuff in there. Again, I'm not like a Group B rally expert. But it is interesting to me that the quintessential, the iconic Group B rally car is the Audi Sport Quattro. And it really was not the dominant car of that class, which really was the Peugeot. But anyway, so even then though, Audi was working on a successor to that car, but that's not why Audi got out of the business of rally entirely. So 1986 was really the end of the iconic Group B class. First, there was an incident at the Portuguese Rally where Joaquim Santos, who was driving a Ford RS200, came over a crest and had to avoid a small group of spectators. He lost control of his car. He slid into those spectators. He injured 31 of them and killed 3 of them. Then after that was the Tour de Corse in Corsica. The race leader, who was in a Lancia S4, Henry Toivonen, went off the outside of a bend and down to a wooded area. The fuel tank of the car ruptured. The car went up in flames, killing Toivonen and his co-driver, Sergio Cresto. Nobody actually saw the crash to say what might have caused it, if it was a mechanical failure, if it was a driver error, but apparently Toivonen was sick with the flu at the time, which may have contributed. Lastly, there was a televised crash at the ADAC Rally Hessen, where Mark Schurer, who was an Arrows Formula 1 driver at the time, also crashed a Ford RS200, which killed his co-driver, Michel Wider, and that was the end of it. The FIA disestablished Group B for 1987, so they would finish the 1986 season, but then that would be it. The cars had gotten too fast, too powerful. They were just too much for the rally circuits that were going on at the time. Incidentally, I did accidentally watch a GIF of the crash, the Rally Hessen Mark Schurer crash, while trying to find information about the race. I don't recommend watching that. Audi, for their part, did not wait until the end of the season, and they withdrew from rally after the 1986 Tour de Corse. The Sport Quattro S1, however, it wasn't done doing work. The Sport Quattro S1 ended up on Pikes Peak, which was probably the most the single biggest off-road race at the time, and it took the overall win at Pikes Peak in 85, 86, and 1987. So now Audi, at the end of 86, is totally done with rally, but they still want to compete somewhere. So hot off the heels of the total farce, unintended acceleration debacle, where Americans basically couldn't deal with the narrower placement of Audi's gas and brake pedal, Audi had some brand rehab to do in America, and they figured, what better place to do that than on the track? So Audi's first stop on their North American redemption tour was the Trans Am series. So for 88, and for this particular championship, Audi teamed up with Bob Tullius' Group 44 team, who were recently spurned by Jaguar. Group 44 was competing in the IMSA GTP class with the Jaguar XJR5, which I'm sure is also a car that at some point I will talk about this, because when I was growing up, it was one of my absolute favorites. But Jaguar dumped them for our friends from last week, Tom Walkinshaw and TWR. So Tullius and his team took the Audi 200 and stuffed the Sport Quattro drivetrain in it. And by the way, so the Audi 200, if you go and you look up the Audi 200 Trans Am, a lot wider than a factory car and all that stuff, but it was actually based on a real Audi 200 chassis. So it shared a lot more with the road car than the car that we're going to be talking about, which is very much a silhouette car. So if you've been around cars at some point, you have heard the phrase, there's no replacement for displacement. Audi respectfully disagrees. Competing against 310 cubic inch V8s, while the 129 cubic inch Audi wasn't a power disadvantage, the quattro all-wheel drive system, with its Torsen diff and torque vectoring system, Audi felt more than made up for it. I think they're probably down, maybe, it's got to be close to 100 horsepower, 50, 60, 70, 80 at least. I figure the other Trans Am cars are probably making somewhere in that 650 neighborhood. So the main thing about quattro, the system, was it was a full-time system. It was not selectable, like four-wheel drive that you might have in a pickup truck. The transmission's connected to a center diff that apportions power front or rear based on traction needs. In the case of early cars, it was a mechanical differential, but by 87 and the 200 Trans Am, it was a Torsen diff. And I actually just found out, as I was researching this the other day, I always thought Torsen was like a name brand or something like that. Nope. Poor man too of torque sensing. Torsen, torque sensing. So the earliest Torsen diffs, which would have been a T1, would have used crossed helical gears to limit torque splitting. So, driven by Hurley Haywood, the aforementioned Walter Roll, and Hans J. Stuck, who's going to end up being kind of the hero of our story, I suppose, the 200 went and it won 8 of the 13 Trans Am events in which it was entered. Hurley Haywood won the driver championship, and Audi obviously won the constructors. The car is quick on starts. It was great getting through and out of turns. It was reportedly fairly easy on its tires because, you know, you weren't just putting mountains of torque through two rear tires. You get to split it between four. And of course, if it was a wet weather race, I mean, just, you know, the other guys could just hang it up. The Audi was going to run away with it. So really how Haywood actually won the championships is he would let Stuck go and pace the field. He would hang back, save his tires, and mount a charge late in the race. It was actually, it got to be so much that the other competitors thought that Audi was just sandbagging and, you know, that they could have just ran away with the whole thing. But it was Haywood hanging back with his kind of smooth, conservative style, and that really lended itself to the Audi. Stuck had a harder time getting used to the car. His driving style, I'm just going to let Hans Stuck tell you about his driving style.
To adopt my driving style to all-wheel drive suspension in cars was not so easy, because my style always was a little bit spectacular, like going sideways and people saying he has more flies and bugs on the doors than he has on the windscreen by driving so much sideways. And it also helped me in my sports car driving. I got smoother and more, not so aggressive and not so a twitchy driving style, and improved everything.
But for 1989, Trans Am took a turn and basically became a class for American-branded vehicles, and they banned all-wheel drive. So Audi was pushed out, and they turned their sights on the most popular American GT racing series, which at the time was the IMSA GT Championship. So by the time that Audi entered the IMSA GT Championship, it was, to me, a fairly welcome place for manufacturers to come and just try out things that they wanted to try. The series allowed space frame, you know, tube chassis cars, and while the cars did have to resemble what they were supposed to be, you know, as like a silhouette anyway, you could go to a track up to 79 inches wide. So for reference, a 1989 Audi 90 has a track of about 56 inches. So Audi was able to add what I think is just a insulting to the Audi 90, 23 inches of width to their wheel track. This makes the 90 GTO approximately 40% wider than its road-going counterpart. So like, imagine that you go and you interview for a job and somebody says, you know, we like you, we want to base this job around you, but we just need somebody that is just 40% better than you are. That's essentially what Audi said to the 90. The car almost looks square. It's such an 80s shape, it's ridiculous. The rear fenders by the windows are just like perfectly flat. You could eat a steak off of them. It's great. The extra width there, 100% necessary, because Audi fitted the car with 14-inch wide slicks at all four corners. Wheels were center lug BBS parts with those awesome 1980s cooling fans, you know, that they used to put on top of the wheels. I think underneath they were like a gold mesh, you know, just a nice looking wheel, but you had to have the 80s cooling fans. Tires, as seems to be the case with all of the best 1980s racing cars, came from Goodyear. I don't care what anybody says, There's nothing that looks better on a racing tire than just white Goodyear and Eagle on the other side. It's the best look. So steering, braking, suspension, transmission were all pretty much open. You could make the body out of whatever you wanted. Most manufacturers opted for fiberglass. Ground effect was banned, but wings were fine, and there were weight penalties for turbocharged cars. Engine changes were allowed, but you couldn't change the number of valves, ports, or spark plugs from your homologated engine. Basically, this was a prototype class where your car had to wear a production car costume. The only piece of factory sheet metal, in fact, that the 90 GTO wore was the series-mandated stock roof. Under the hood was an evolution of the Sport Quattro's engine. This is a 2.2-liter, 20-valve, inline 5-cylinder engine. It was developed by Michael Gans. It made 720 horsepower with a massive single KKK turbocharger. Iron block, aluminum head, or the Germans would call a light alloy head, so I'm sure it's some form of aluminum, but not just straight-up aluminum. So pretty standard for that. One cool thing that I did find out about the engine, so usually your head is bolted to your block, and then your crank is bolted into the head, and both bolts from separate sides. Audi apparently ran studs the whole way through. So the studs went through the head, through the block, through the crankcase, and ended at the actual the bearing caps for the crankshaft. So Audi's thought was, if we're pumping 3 bar of boost through this thing, let's just kind of sandwich everything together and just make the thing as tough as they possibly could, which did seem to work because the car actually held together pretty well. It was fairly reliable for, a small cubic inch engine making 700 horsepower and ungodly amounts of turbo boost. It was backed up by a 6-speed H-pattern gearbox, no sequential box, no PDK. The one gear was blocked because IMSA would only let you have a maximum of 5 gears. If you look at the car, the layout there is interesting in that it seems to be the reverse of what you would want. The engine is longitudinally positioned, so the engine is in line with the car, and the entire engine sits out in front of the front axle. If you look at a picture of it, the back of the motor seems to be out even in front of the front tires, and the transmission is right behind the front wheels. So the reason for this setup, obviously, is the Quattro system, which uses a torsen-centered diff. You end up with a front-heavy car, but Audi feels that the Quattro setup was worth the trade-off, and honestly, from the results, I'm going to have to go ahead and agree with them. It's also a fabulous-sounding car. Just pops, whirs, and turbo chirping. The exhaust exits through what would be the passenger door, just in a giant sewer pipe sticking right out the side of the door, just coming straight off the turbo. It's awesome. So unlike in 1988 in the Trans Am series, 1989 in IMSA was a full Audi factory effort. Drivers Hurley Haywood and Hans Stuck were retained as full-time drivers. Walter Roll and Scott Goodyear also drove the cars in longer events. Haywood and Stuck, as they did in Trans Am, once again made for a very solid pairing, with Stuck famed for his aggressive driving style, Haywood being the opposite.
My driving strategy is to go always 100% or as close as possible. If I sit in a race car, I adjust my mind and I want to go for it. Sometimes it's bad, sometimes it's good. But if I'm as a professional racing driver, you have to be like this.
So as an aside, you remember Group 44? We talked about they ran the Audi Trans Am team the year before. They ended up being kind of a victim, I suppose, of their own success. So Audi ditched them, went and did their own thing. And Group 44, the last thing that they ended up doing was they went to NASCAR for 89 and 90. They only ran about 9 races before Bob Tullia shut the team down after 1990, which is unfortunate. Group 44 is a team with a lot of history. They ran everything. They did these Audis, they did Triumph TR6s, they did had a long program with Jaguar where they ran V12 E-types and XJSs and all the way up to the XJR5, which I'm sure is a car that I'm going to be talking about at some point. So Audi's main competition in 1989 would come from the 88 champion, which is Roush Racing, and also newcomer Cunningham Racing, both with cars that were just super different from the Audi. Roush had run cars that were bodied as Mercury XR4 TIs in 1988, which, if you're familiar with that car, is the weird American version of the Ford Sierra. For 1989, they rebodied the cars as Mercury Cougars. So they were sponsored by Stroh's Light, which is a beer that I'm fairly sure still exists. And the Cougars were a good-looking race car. They were dark blue with a red stripe on the bottom and gold lace wheels. Real, real sharp car. Depending on the track, the cars either ran with a V8 or with a turbocharged 2.3-liter inline 4. And apparently the V8s were used for Sebring and Daytona. You could tell them apart because the V8s had a big hood bulge. So Cunningham was also new for 89 along with Audi, and they brought Nissan 300 ZXs. True to their street car, the Nissans were powered by a twin-turbo V6, and they appeared in one of the all-time great liveries, which is Nissan's classic red, white, and blue, which I mean, Nissan just put on everything from off-road trucks to GTP cars back then. It was just one of those designs that just, it couldn't miss. It looked good on everything. Cunningham's GTO effort also actually joined Nissan's GTP effort, which is run by Electromotive. And Electromotive was coming off of a driver's championship with the Nissan GTP ZX Turbo and driver Jeff Brabham. The engine actually in the 300 ZX was largely similar to the motor being run in the GTP ZX Turbo, detuned a little bit because that car was just a monster. So Audi's season had a little bit of a delayed start, just first on purpose, and then not. So Audi decided to skip the season opening 24 hours of Daytona, which was won handily by the number 16 Roush Cougar. As far as Audi was concerned, the 90 GTO was still a car that was in development at that time. They didn't think that it was going to make it through a full 24-hour race, which they were correct, because when the car did finally show up in Miami, Hunchduck made it about 19 laps into the race before losing the transmission, so he only made it about two-thirds of the way through. The following race was the 12 Hours of Sebring, which Audi also skipped, because honestly, the 12 Hours of Sebring, you know, I realize it's only half as long as the 24 Hours of Daytona, but that's still just a grueling race because of Sebring's surface. Audi's first full race was at Summit Point, which about 2 months after Miami, Stuck would qualify the car second and end up winning the race outright.
We didn't finish Miami because our gearbox broke. We found that we had too much horsepower for our gearbox and drive shafts. And then I must say, from Miami to the next race, to Summit Point, there was only about 9 weeks in between, but what the Audi crew was able to achieve in these 9 weeks was the maximum I've ever seen in my 20 years of racing. They were working so bloody hard, day and night. I doubted, actually, when I came to Summit Point, we're going to run longer than 1 hour.
So from that race on, Stuck would go on to win 7 of the remaining 11 GTO races for the season, often in dominant fashion. In fact, towards the end of the season, one of the Roush Cougars even sported a sticker between its brake lights of Hans Stuck's face, although it was circled in red with a line through it. Teammate Hurley Haywood, though not a race winner that season, ended up on the podium 7 times. Stuck finished 3rd in the points, Haywood 4th, in spite of not running at Daytona or Sebring. If Audi had had an earlier start in development and had run those races, I mean, I'm pretty certain that it would have been a championship double for Audi and Stuck. So the main way in which Audi won against their competition was traction into braking zones and out of turns. When you have a rear drive car like Audi's competitors did, the car is much more difficult to balance under braking. The Audi, with its Torsen Quattro system, applied power equally to all four wheels under braking. So this kept the car stable, which allowed the drivers to brake harder, later, and with much greater confidence. And of course, when you have power going to all four wheels and not just two, you can get the power down much more quickly coming out of turns. Audi's opponents would pass in the straights, but Audi could pass anywhere. The Audi was, like its 200 Quattro Trans Am predecessor, also fairly light on its tires. So in races that other cars had to pit midway to come in through tires, Audi could push the tires longer. So Audi's dominance of the series at the end of the year, unfortunately, prompted the IMSA GT Championship to do exactly what Trans Am had done the year before, and that at the end of the season, they banned all-wheel drive race cars, which ended Audi's involvement in the series after only one season, albeit an enormously successful one. It's unfortunate to me. It seems like a stiflement of development. I mean, they could have done weight penalties. Decreased Audi's tire width or something. There's things that IMSA could have done other than just straight up banning all-wheel drive, which to me, that's not, that's not the way I would do it. I like the innovation of all-wheel drive, and let let Roush and let Cunningham come up with ways to beat it, you know? So Audi's legacy in America in only 2 years is one of just complete domination. Between the 200 Trans Am and the 90 GTO, Audi entered 26 races and won 15 of them. I have no doubt that if IMSA hadn't outlawed all-wheel drive for 1990, we'd be talking about Audi as a 24 Hours of Daytona champion, and they would have won that championship double with Hans Stuck. I suppose maybe Haywood, too, if he would have gotten a better handle on it, but, you know, Stuck was faster. It's also a little bit ironic to me that the races Audi didn't run in 89 were the endurance races, when from 99 to 2016 they won the 24 Hours of Le Mans 13 times. So, I mean, what Audi ended up being known for was the one thing that they didn't do when the 90 GTO was there. As for Audi, the team and the drivers, you don't really need to shed any tears for them getting kicked out of IMSA. Hurley Haywood would continue racing for another 20-plus years. He'd go on to win the 24 Hours of both Daytona and Le Mans. As for Stuck and Audi, they'd return to Germany for 1990. So, booted out of IMSA, Audi decided to take their new large saloon car and compete the DTM, Deutsche Tourenwagen Masters, which is the German touring car championship. So Audi brought their new car, which was their first powered by a V8, and in typical German fashion, the car was very creatively named the Audi V8. They threw their Quattro system in it and promptly won the championship in their first season. Audi took 9 wins in the 22-race season. 7 of those were the work of Hans Stuck. The other went one apiece to Walter Roll and a young Frank Biele, who would go on to become an Audi legend in the same manner as Stuck. Frank Biele, definitely a guy that we'll be talking about probably in the Audi R8 episodes and in the Audi A4 BTCC episodes, which are definitely coming, you guys. I'm sorry, they just are. On the upside, though, the competition history of the 90 GTO doesn't entirely end there. So one of them ended up apparently in South Africa. And it's since been gone through and re-engined and rebodied and all sorts of things. And now it is apparently called, or at some point it was called the 100 GTO C4 Extreme. And now I guess it has a Audi 80 body on it. So it's an Audi 80 competition. So there is still, apparently, one Audi 90 GTO out there doing stuff. And I'll just dominating the racing that it's in as well. So even in, I guess, what would be its afterlife, the 90 GTO has still just been a dominant car. So fortunately for me, the 90 GTO is a car that is available in a sim that I have access to. So I ran the car in Project Cars 2 at Laguna Seca, which is a track where Stuck won with the car in 1989. As far as sim racing cars go, this thing is, it's a riot to drive. It's powerful, it's, you know, yeah, all the traction coming out of the turns, it's easy to get, you know, it turns in easily despite being all-wheel drive. You would think maybe with the all-wheel drive system that it might want to push. It does want to push a little bit on exit if you get on the power too quickly, you know, because it, you know, you get the front wheels going. In that game, though, it does bias it, I think, a lot to the rear, where, you know, in real life the car would have had much more sophisticated systems than what they replicate in Project Cars 2. But it is great, you know, it was an easy car to get power oversteer, which is a lot of fun with all-wheel drive. It performed well while pushed hard, like Stuck would drive it, and it was also quick driving it smoothly, like Hurley Haywood would. You know, that is the Audi 90 GTO. It's just such a cool car. It's one of those cars I was aware of, but I had a really great time going through and finding out more about it and learning stuff about the car, which I was happy about. I haven't totally decided what the next episode's going to be, but given that I'm recording this on Tuesday, and I won't even get to start the next one until Wednesday, I'm leaning towards something a little bit shorter. I think I might go with the Hudson Hornet. Why not? I haven't been to NASCAR yet. I don't think I've been to the 1950s. So, all right, you know what? Next episode, Hudson Hornet. I don't know exactly when it'll be up. It probably, well, definitely won't run as long as this episode, but yeah, fabulous Hudson Hornet, 1951 to 1954. Let's do the Hudson Hornet. So anyway, guys, thanks for listening. If you have any suggestions, you can get me on Twitter at racecarpodcast, or you can shoot me an email, racecarpodcast@gmail.com. You know, if you have any feedback about sound quality stuff, because this is the first episode where I'm inserting sound into the episode. I'm trying to get all the levels good, so I don't want to blow anybody's ears out. Although, if you're going to have your ears blown out, there are certainly worse sounds to do that with than, you know, the sound of the Audi 90 GTO. So I'm going to leave you in closing with some 90 GTO sound. So thanks for listening, guys. I'll talk to you later.